This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Turmeric Liposome Complex, a natural solution to chronic pain. Future Farm's liquid turmeric with liposomes and nanotechnology delivers maximum absorption for effective pain relief. Sourced and manufactured in the United States, this product contains 1,600 milligrams of curcumin and powerful antioxidant properties. This plant-based curcumin is used to possibly reduce inflammation, block proteins that trigger swelling, and intercept inflammatory pathways, significantly decreasing inflammatory responses. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Don't live with pain when there's an all-natural, science-based remedy that works without adverse side effects. Get free shipping on all of your orders at myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and the topic once again is COVID-19. Yeah, I wish we didn't have to keep talking about it, but it keeps rearing its ugly head. And even as we're contemplating relaxing the lockdown strictures across the country, new cases seem to be popping up, and some of the states and some of the municipalities are retrenching on their plans to open up restaurants and open up public places. So I thought it'd be appropriate to talk to an expert on the subject. Dr. Jaime Salas Rushford is a traditionally trained physician who practices regenerative and functional medicine. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, he has been working on the front lines with patients in New York and in Puerto Rico. And of special interest is that he's currently working with New York companies in rental real estate, distribution and tech to help them get their employees back to work by writing opening protocols and establishing testing logistics. So we're going to be talking a little bit about the way back. That's important at this point. He's here to talk about how businesses can help employees prepare their immune systems for a second wave of COVID-19. He is also a believer in natural support for the immune system. We'll get to that momentarily. But we want to get people back to work safely and to avoid the spread of this virus. So welcome, Dr. Salas Rushford. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Same here. Thank you for having me.
And by the way, he trained at the University of Puerto Rico. He completed his medical training here in New York at St. Vincent's Hospital, Mount Sinai Medical Center. And he is board certified in anti-aging, regenerative, and functional medicine. So he's certainly a kindred spirit practicing in an integrative fashion. He's also author of Fight Colds, Flu, and Other Infections with AHCC. And we want to get to that subject because AHCC, Advanced Hexose Correlated Compound, is part of our immune support armamentarium. So, all right. Well, what's your reading of the current situation? It seems that, we've taken two steps forward and maybe a step backward this week. The stock market plummeted on news that there were more and more cases, especially in the South and the West. Certain states are seeing an uptick in cases. And does this portend the dread second wave? What do you think?
Well, it's interesting because I'm still in New York, by the way. I've been going back and forth from Puerto Rico, so I'm currently in Manhattan. So I've been talking to my colleagues that we volunteered for a few weeks. I actually did 8 weeks in the Brooklyn Hospital, Coney Island, treating the COVID overflow patients. And we've just been brainstorming as to what's going on. And basically, we think New York had the virus much, much earlier on, and meaning, November, October, November, December last year. I do have a patient that was very, very sick in December, mid-December. I had no clue what he had. This weird pneumonia. Mm-hmm. He had all the, obviously looking back, now I know what he had, right?
Right. It's kind of like the early days of HIV when, people were 4+ sick. We didn't know what was going on with them. And it was only, months or even years later that we defined it as the HIV virus.
Correct. And then, the interesting thing is that this patient, I was back and forth. I couldn't figure it out. He got better, just supported treatment. And a month later, not sorry, apologize for the.
I hope you're wearing your mask. Are you wearing your mask? Okay, because
I'm in my apartment, so I'm good.
Okay, so we're socially distanced, yeah. So I feel okay about it, even if you occasionally cough.
I just drank a little water there, and it got went through the wrong side.
Okay.
So when the testing came in, I just decided to take my prior patients in the city and have them tested. You know, PCR and antibodies. And this particular patient actually had very high antibody. Mm-hmm. Very high antibody test. So that means that what I treated back in mid-December was COVID.
Wow.
So it makes you wonder as to mm-hmm. when COVID actually was in the city, and maybe people were getting exposed without us knowing, and more people were getting exposed being city so, you know, cosmopolitan. There's no way to getting in the subway without right. bumping to 20,000 people too. So,
and I can share with you that this has been my experience as well. As you know, knock wood, I haven't been sick, but family members have been sick in peculiar ways. You know, usually when somebody gets a cold, they don't experience shortness of breath. I know at least a couple of family members who experienced some of that.
Correct.
But also, many patients report being very sick in January and February, and that was well before we raised the alarm for COVID-19. That leads us to believe that maybe, paradoxically, what's happening is we're seeing a lot of cases in Texas, in Florida, in certain parts of California, Arizona. But interestingly, there are fewer cases in New York, and the number of deaths has dwindled to, you know, a mere handful here.
Correct.
in you know, where, which used to be the killing zone. I mean, you were in Coney Island. My goodness, that was really hard hit.
We were having thousands of patients a night and during the day. So it was tough. And then it begs to wonder as if we had this condition or this virus before and people were just getting sick and we were not conscious that it was COVID. We were treating just the flu or whatever symptoms we had.
Mm-hmm.
So our main consensus is that people actually were exposed and got it before. Now they're past and, you know, they're healed from this. So that's why we might not be seeing so many patients from the reopening, quote unquote, of New York City. And then when I sat down with this particular patient, other, you know, how you sat down in the corner of the street and basically everything now is outside.
Yeah.
Other patients came about and neighborhoods came in and they're saying, look, I actually got sick too in December. I had the same thing.
Yeah.
So now you're having this anecdotal references of people that were getting sick, yet we didn't know what it was. So I think that's what happened. New York was very exposed very early on before we knew it. And the rest of the country, it's more spread out. You know, they're not going to be on top of each other in mass transit.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it lagged behind. And now that everybody was in their homes for three, four months, they wanted to see the grandparents go out. They might venture more than the 5 mile radius I usually drive from your home
mm-hmm.
and just spread like wildfire in the outside. Yep. So I think that's sort of like main consensus here in the city.
Yeah, a couple of things going on in New York and in, you know, big cities in the Northeast is that we got hit hard. And I think people got the message early that this was very serious. And so there was a lot of quarantining, social distancing. People wore masks to the extent that they're beneficial. You know, they offer some partial protection, I believe. And in addition, there's this issue of herd immunity. But
correct.
As you know, in order to achieve herd immunity, you have to have the majority of the population exposed to this. And surely, maybe significant double digits of the population in New York have been exposed to it, maybe some asymptomatic, unbeknownst to them. But
correct.
I doubt if we've really hit the threshold for herd immunity. Is it your belief that you can get partial herd immunity, that it's maybe not a complete block to propagation of the virus, but maybe like a speed bump in its progression if maybe 20 or 25% of people are exposed?
You, since you lived in the New York City, we're talking about the boroughs, right?
Yeah.
It's a different phenomenon. Here, people really don't venture more than a few blocks from their home. Even though it's a small city, like, you know, 5 miles wide, if you live in Chelsea, you're not going to go to West Village or East Village. You stay
mm-hmm.
in Chelsea, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, people are talking, it's like one of the neighborhoods within Manhattan. So I think we were able to achieve herd immunity by little villages or places around the city that were getting exposed. And honestly, you know, when I'm in the city, I don't venture more than 4 or 5 blocks to get whatever I need, everything I can find within the five-minute walking.
Yeah.
So I think we had miniature herd immunity sectors in the city that helped us out.
Mm-hmm.
And also a lot of people at the very beginning just fled the city. You know, there were moving companies and they're fleeing, you know, students and people that were almost due to the rent. They just fled.
Exactly.
So the city is quite empty. If you actually live and walk now versus 4 months ago, it's maybe a fifth of what you can see walking on the street.
Exactly. Yeah, it would seem like a ghost town at some point. And thems that had the resources to get out of Dodge, I mean, they went to Connecticut, Westchester, the Hamptons. You know, the stores were overwhelmed in the Hamptons because they usually get ready for the summer season around Memorial Day. Well, Memorial Day came early, and the stores emptied out pretty quickly because so many people had fled their Manhattan apartments. So, bottom line, I mean, are we going to see a major resurgence of coronavirus in your estimation, or is this just a little bit of a temporary setback, an uptick that will eventually peter out?
I honestly think it's the same wave. You know, we got the high tide in New York, and it's just making its way through the mm-hmm. U.S. now.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's a second wave or a second infection. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just now people came out. You know, it's normal. When you're locked down for 3 months, you have to go out, you're going to visit your family, you're going to visit your uncle 10 miles away, you're going to, your kids are going to play with the other kids. So I think it's just a continuation of the same way. The only thing is we were not able to identify with early testing where those hops of disease were. And now we're kind of getting a natural herd immunity where like everybody's getting exposed to an extent that the disease is going to run its course through the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're seeing.
And an interesting statistic I saw the other day from a preliminary study, I think it was out of Italy, that showed that in the age group 20 to 39, 80% of people who tested positive didn't recall ever having it. They were asymptomatic. So just a sort of an amazing statistic suggesting that now, of course, that proportion changes, you know, as you progress in age, as you go, you know, 65 and above or 70 and above. But I think in terms of the deaths, the average age of people who died was, you know, in the 80s.
Also, if you notice, we're getting less deaths in general.
Yeah.
Obviously, we don't want people to die, but mm-hmm. we're getting less deaths in general. And I think early recognition and more people are more conscious that they can actually have COVID and get help. What we noticed in the hospital, in the ER, was that people that stayed home 5, 7, 10 days with symptoms were very hard to treat versus people that came in, you know, 2, 3 days into whatever symptom they have, might be from mm-hmm. fever to diarrhea, whatever it was easier to treat and easier to discharge.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that lag of treatment of people getting help, since it's shorter, is helping out too, because now doctors know what to do. They know how to symptomatically treat. Yet there's no cure, but if you attack fever very early on, it's easier to treat a patient versus having somebody with 103 fever for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we saw in the hospital.
And there was this big hue and cry about ventilators. We need more ventilators. But then it turned out that the prognosis for people on ventilators was pretty miserable, and I think now they've sort of rethought it. I mean, yes, some people absolutely require assisted breathing with ventilators, but there seem to be less invasive ways of providing oxygen support and breathing support for people that's short of putting them on ventilators.
We actually moved away from ventilators very early on. We noticed that ventilators are not helping, and we identified the blood clots that COVID creates very early on. So as you know, a lot of people were dying. We're not sure why. It's because the disease, for whatever reason, messes with the coagulation system mm-hmm. and profile of the body, and they were getting pulmonary emboli in the legs. So we identified that very early on, and we started anticoagulating patients early. And we moved away from actual real ventilators, the actual intubation. And we mm-hmm. went to machines like CPAP, or mm-hmm. for those listeners, less invasive ways of ventilating the patient. And we noticed that if we could avoid to intubate the patient, the better we could manage them mm-hmm. at the long run. So
we did shy away. I think people don't realize how devastating an experience it is to be put on a ventilator, because you have to be sedated. You're being breathed artificially. In effect, you become sort of a vegetable you know, in a clamorous ICU with nonstop alarms and noise and, you know, fluorescent Correct. Lights 24/7. And that, you know, is not exactly a healing atmosphere.
No, and for people that are weak in their lungs, the ventilator kind of takes over so much that it's hard for the body to get rid of the ventilator, wean them off, take them off the ventilator. You need muscle strength in your lungs, actually, in your lung muscles to be able to breathe on your own. Once you're a ventilator, those muscles relax or atrophy in a way that when you need them and you take the ventilator off, you're no longer there.
It's hard to wean people off them, yeah.
Correct. And so we actually very early on started not to use or try not to use ventilators as much as we can. And we noticed that we can manage with different other non-invasive ventilating machines better.
There's been some talk of repurposing old drugs. I mean, yes, they're looking for the magic bullet drugs, you know, the big ticket medications like remdesivir, very targeted antivirals. Some of them are investigatory, some of them are yet to be developed. But we actually seem to be getting some mileage out of some pretty inexpensive old-fashioned drugs, right?
I can tell you a few experiences on different ones, and obviously people can get from it whatever they want to get. What I found the most effective was early symptom treatment. Things so simple as Tylenol, cold, and flu, and hydration with Pedialyte, when you got the first symptoms, actually brought people out of, you know, the condition much quicker, because at the end of the day, your body is fighting the disease. You need to give your body the adequate tools to fight and be able to fight fever, diarrhea, headaches, and so forth. So those people that we actually were very symptomatic-oriented treatment, meaning if you have a fever, we're going to bring it down. If you're dehydrated, we're going to hydrate you. If you have pain, we're going to take care of the pain. Those people actually were able to make it home quicker than you had, you know, the other bunch of those who came sicker. And we tried remdesivir, we tried Plaquenil, which is hydroxychloroquine, which I have to say we did, in my personal experience, I did have very good outcomes with it. It was a hit and miss. On the patients, we gave it and it really worked. They came out of it immediately.
In the clinical trials, and actually a couple of them were withdrawn, one from Lancet, one from New England Journal of Medicine.
Correct.
Said it didn't work. But I talked to so many clinicians, frontline doctors, and I've spoken to some patients who said, you know, as soon as we use the hydroxychloroquine, the symptoms would resolve within 48 hours. Now, that may be coincidental, but, you know, it's anecdotal, but, you know.
But that was exactly what I, on the patients that worked, that's what I saw. I actually went to Jersey. They called me from this one of the hotels, one of the volunteer nurses from Puerto Rico actually was very sick. He's been there for 5 days. He was literally about to be intubated. He didn't want to go to hospital. Obviously, we know as clinicians what that means.
Yeah.
So they reached me out and say, if I could actually make it over there. So I got a friend, he drove me, and what made the difference was that medication.
Wow.
After 48 hours, he was no longer needing like a CPAP that we brought in. He was good. Obviously, we give him good hydration, we give everything else, but you wonder how, after starting that particular medication, he actually was able to make it through those 2 days and be able to actually walk out of there. Mm-hmm. So again, it was a hit or miss, but the people that actually helped beautifully. Remdesivir, we used it in the ICU. It's a more complicated drug to give IV and everything else.
Very expensive.
So that was, I cannot tell you one way or the other. Our experience is that it really didn't make a big difference. Mm-hmm. But again, those were really, really sick patients who were at that extra end of sickness that were very hard to treat.
Right.
So if we were giving to healthier patients, that would be a big difference, but we were giving it to the terminally ill, you know, that extra leg to, we tried everything and might as well try this kind of attitude. The other thing that helped, and we'll bring it soon, and I had a very personal experience, is, you know, supplements. People that were keen on supplements and taking care of the body, that symptoms, and I started asking, you know, you do exercise, what do you take, my multivitamin, everything else. And those had a pretty more robust system or body to be able to fight it. And actually, they walked out of the ER pretty good. You know, they were sick, yes, but they were able to walk out.
So they weren't invulnerable, but they were more resilient to the effects of the virus. They were greater likelihood of mild symptoms and survival.
Correct. So, and it just, again, it just begs to wonder what helped, a combination of everything helped, or what did we do? What we did learn was that the early intervention, early detection, actually helps us treat patients better.
So there's a lot of talk about comorbidities and predisposing factors. So if we were to take a little bit of a different perspective, to talk to people about how they might coronavirus-proof themselves, what are some of the factors that might be involved?
Well, it is a lung condition, right? It's a pneumonia. Very typical, weird pneumonia that affects other organs too. And people will think that people that have lung conditions are more predisposed to being worse off with COVID. Yet we found that people with coronary hypertension and different cardiac diseases were more exposed to it. And I think part of the reason that's why, is because remember, this virus is creating blood clots and pulmonary emboli and clotting a lot of those little arteries and veins in the lungs, which increases, in theory, all the vascular pressure. So the heart needs to work mm-hmm. harder mm-hmm. to overcome that increased resistance.
Even with a fever alone can put an extra demand on cardiac output.
Correct. And those people with a weak heart, you're struggling this little heart much more, you know, and then it fails on you. And then once it fails, everything else fails with it. Mm-hmm. So I think that particular coagulation effect of COVID has a lot to do with mortality and morbidity. And that it's one of the key elements that we need to look for in order to see who's going to be more affected or not.
So it would affect cardiopulmonary fitness would be somewhat of a shield against bad outcomes.
In theory, it should, yes. The stronger the heart you can, the more leeway you have for the body to try to fight it off and you know, deal with everything. But again, even the strongest, I had this volleyball player. He was 6'2".
Mm-hmm.
He was strong as an ox.
Yeah.
He was huge, muscle. You know, you're the perfect example of what fitness is. And mm-hmm. he was brought to his knees from COVID.
Yeah.
He made it out okay, mm-hmm. but he was to his knees by the disease. So again, it's one of those things that the important thing is early detection and having that malice, just thinking everything is COVID right now and treating very aggressively early on.
Mm-hmm. Dexamethasone has figured in the management of patients. Have you found it? You know, it's literally pennies per dose. Old-fashioned steroid medication. Have you used that at all?
Well, in my prior patients, the equivalent was the Medrol pack, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I used it early on with montelukast and different asthma medications.
Yeah, singular.
And levobutyrol, Sulpinex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I used that combination with my prior patients, and I was able to improve symptoms quicker than if they didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that people complain is after they got COVID, they have this lagging fatigue, this chronic fatigue, chest tightness kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I found that giving Sulpinex treatments and singular in combination actually made him feel quicker, better.
Mm-hmm.
So again, they're anti-inflammatory drugs in a sense. So it takes the inflammation away from the lungs and you're going to feel better. So all that plays into this anti-inflammatory, you know, kind of road into trying to treat what COVID brings to us.
Okay. You know, we've laid the groundwork for a discussion in part two of some of the things that can help form a bulwark against infection. You're working on, you know, a couple of aspects of that. You're helping businesses work on ways of getting employees back to work by writing opening protocols and establishing testing logistics. We'll talk a little bit about that. We'll also talk about some of the things that we can do to fortify our immune systems, because it was your impression that people who took supplements, especially certain ones, were better equipped to weather coronavirus infections. Our guest, Dr. Jaime Salas Rushford, he's been on the front lines of treating this, and we'll be right back with more of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast.